Hello, my name is Chip Lang. You're listening to Total EM. Today I have with me Aaron Inouye, and he is here to talk about a unique role that he's currently in, which is as a single coverage PA working in a small emergency department. I don't want to take too much away because it's a really interesting thing, and especially in his particular circumstance, because he's not obviously the only PA out there doing this, but I think it's something we need to celebrate and celebrate the unique roles. And really what this podcast is all about is for people who are practicing in this kind of setting, especially PAs. Of course, we hit all sorts of topics for anything from the academic major tertiary center all the way to the small six-bed ED that Aaron's working in. So I don't want to take anything away from Aaron. Aaron, could you introduce yourself here real quick?
Yeah. Hi, Chip. Thanks for having me on. Like you said, my name's Aaron Inouye. I'm a PA working in a critical access hospital in southern Idaho. Graduated from school just over a year ago, and I've been out here since then.
And you just had your first kid, right? You're married, had your first kid. Seems like you've been staying busy there.
We're super excited. We have a little boy named Henry who's almost 2 months. So that's been a big adjustment for us, but it's been super fun.
Now, you're like the classic PA I think of that's working out west, because you do all sorts of stuff. You even got involved in the ski patrol, and from the way we're talking about wilderness medicine and from the way we're talking about everything, really it sounds like that's kind of how you got into emergency medicine in the first place.
That is totally what drew me into medicine. I actually took my first kind of introduction to medicine was in college. I did a Knowles course that had a wilderness first responder component to it. And that kind of got me thinking that I'd like to do that. But it took me a few years to come back to it. And then I went through a wilderness EMT course, started ski patrolling then, and working part-time on an ambulance as an EMT. And I think spent about 6 years doing that before I ended up going back to PA school. But yeah, it was that kind of outdoor emergency medicine that really kind of first pulled me in.
Then you graduated, like you said, last August, correct? And then What's been going on since then?
So I graduated from Pacific University out in Oregon last August. My wife and I took a real quick, very, very delayed honeymoon, traveled around Europe for a few weeks. And then we both grew up in southern Idaho, so we moved back here to be a little bit closer to family and get back to the mountains. And I started working at a small hospital here in Gooding, Idaho, in the emergency department.
And how many beds is it again?
So we have a six-bed emergency department, two big trauma rooms, and then a couple smaller rooms, and one room set up for peds. The whole hospital, we've got a 18-bed med-surg floor. And like I was saying before, it's critical access hospital. Our closest tertiary center is probably 40 to 45 minutes away. Closest trauma center is in Boise, which is about an hour and a half by ground. You know, we have the emergency department. We have all local family providers providing the hospital a service. So it's kind of a little more of that old school feel in that sense, where your family doc is also the doc who's going to be taking care of you in the hospital with us, which I think has definite pros and cons.
This is actually reminds me a lot of the very first place I worked at. The first place I worked at, it was at small ED. It wasn't technically always solo coverage. Actually, I came in a lot of times more support, but the family practice or internal medicine doc is going to be the hospitalist that day, and you're going to take care of the same patients. There was at one point two general surgeons, then another point there was one general surgeon. For a brief period, we had no general surgeon at all, and just specialists who come in and visit from time and again, and our imaging was a lot more limited. We didn't have bedside ultrasound except for in our small little ICU, which I don't think a lot of places would even consider as a step down, just because of how things are different there, which we'll talk about more here in a few minutes. But it's so different an environment. And I think it's something a lot of people are probably thinking in the back of their head. Aaron, you just said you've only been at this for about a year. So what led you to taking a solo coverage ED, which is usually something that people are going to say you need to get quite a few years experience or be very, very competent. Not to say that you're not, but how did you end up taking this specific job? Because that's quite a challenge right out of school.
It's definitely been a challenge, and it was a big decision deciding to come out here and take the job. So one of my professors in PA school used to work out here, and he actually started out here straight out of school as well. And he's the one who first kind of directed me over this direction. I was lucky I got to do a rotation out here, my last rotation. So I spent 6 weeks before I graduated, which was huge because I had a chance to be here with somebody else all the time and kind of get a feel for what it would look like if I came out here. I think the thing that really makes it work here is the support that my boss provides. He's also a PA. He runs a small PA staffing business that just staffs emergency departments, which he's been doing for the last 20 or 30 years, and he provides a lot of training. It's a solo coverage position. When I first started, you know, obviously it was not solo. He was in the hospital with me anytime there was a patient there, and then he slowly stepped back as he became more comfortable with me and I became more comfortable with what I was doing. But even today, and I think any time, he's been very clear that if there's ever questions or problems, he's always available. And if he's not available, then one of our coworkers is available. So there's a really excellent backup system that I think is what makes this work. Maybe similar to what you were saying, where you got called in for all the acute, really sick patients as backup. So we do have that little more informal system set up here, which makes it very doable. And then having professor who I really respected to talk to and share his experience of coming out here right after school. And he was, you know, very honest and upfront as far as it's a pretty terrifying 1, 2, 3 years as you're learning, but you're going to learn a lot, and it is doable. The nursing staff here is amazing, very supportive, and good at what they do. I think that makes it happen as well. There was another professor, an MD professor, who I talked with about this, and you know, I was really back and forth about whether this was a good idea, whether it was safe, you know, both for patients and for me as a new grad coming out without any formal experience working. As we were talking, he said, you know, any job you go out to, you're going to learn a ton your first couple of years, but if you take this job, it's going to be a lot more work, it's going to be a lot more stress, it's going to be a lot harder, but the rewards for that are going to just be astronomical, and you're going to learn so much more in that type of position, which I think is totally accurate, and I think has been very true the last 12 months.
I think this ties into some of the challenges that we kind of talked about with a setting like yours, where you may be the only person, not just because you may be the only person, but it may be a little bit harder to get the education because, yes, you get to see a lot of things, and it sounds like you've got great support there. But a lot of this is going to be more independent learning, correct?
Absolutely. It's huge. I think that was another hesitation is, you know, if you go to a large hospital or even a medium-sized hospital, you might have the hospital putting on grand rounds or at least regular continuing ed programs for all the providers there. Or if you're working alongside somebody there every day who's been doing this for the last 20 years, you've got them as a resource. That's not always the case here. So, well, I can always learn from Jay and Ben and my other coworkers. I feel like it's a lot more dependent on myself or on me to put that time in outside of work. And again, to go find other resources, because as you know, there's a million different ways to reduce a dislocated shoulder, and everybody seems to have their one way that they like and works well for them. If you're only working and training with one person, and you just don't get exposed to the depth of options out there. And I think not having that depth is really a detriment to yourself and your patients. So yeah, I feel like I do have to be a little more independent in making sure I'm pushing myself to keep finding new sources.
So what about things like bedside ultrasound? Do you have that at your hospital?
Oh man, I'm super glad you asked me about that. We have a bedside ultrasound in the emergency department that is pretty underutilized right now. You know, I did not get any... I think we're at this real interesting point in PA programs and PA training where it is starting to become standard for programs to offer a little more formal ultrasound training while you're in school. And Pacific is integrating that now, but it was not really in place when I was in school there. And then my coworkers and my boss, you know, having graduated, I think is the one who's been out of school the longest is 6 years or so. And then, you know, Jay's been out for a couple decades, didn't get any of that formal ultrasound training while they were in school either, and haven't had opportunities to get that. So they are not using it very much. I use it when I can. I'm trying to make myself use it more. So if I see something that I think is an abscess or cellulitis, I'll try and make myself pull that out and look at it. Not always necessarily to say this is what I'm going to do or not going to do, but to start exposing myself to it. What I'm trying to do, and this ties back, I think, into a bit, some of the benefits of being in this type of position, is get a a little more formal ultrasound training and credentialing program going in our department and in our hospital. We have a great diagnostic imaging department for being a critical access hospital. I think we're super lucky. We have a brand new CT machine. They put an MRI, a brand new MRI machine in a year ago. We have a radiologist who's there usually Monday through Friday during the business days that we can go down to and talk to anytime about questions. So while we're doing our first reads on things, we have him available as an awesome resource, and he looks over all our images. But I'm trying to pull him in as well to get some type of formal program so we can get some ultrasound training and start using it at the bedside, because it really is just the standard of care at this point, I think.
And we've talked about this quite a bit on the podcast before, including Frank Norman and I discussing about different ways of how you can build your own ultrasound program or how to become more competent. And it is something you can still do learning on your own. It's usually good to get some formalized course, especially to fit kind of ASEP standards on this. And we're building our own ultrasound program at my main shop, and that's been a huge undertaking. And I'm helping out with groups like such as Spocus with Frank on trying to increase education. He does a lot of work on that end. But there are some other things you can talk about too. I mean, there are some pitfalls where you can practice on your own, and sometimes you can lead to overtesting if you're not sure, or you know, you have other obstacles as far as worrying about your reputation, the group's reputation, the hospital's reputation. How do you deal with those types of issues?
That is a huge challenge, I think, especially at the end of a long shift. Like, part of the great thing about, maybe not the great thing, something you have to come to terms with, or I've had to come to terms with in emergency medicine, is that you don't always have the answers. It's some of that like feeling of unknown. You can't CT everybody that comes in. Every kid that comes in that throws up does not deserve a CT scan. I think our PA group here has a really strong reputation with local providers and the providers in Twin Falls and Boise. And like you're saying, I do feel that challenge to make sure I'm upholding that reputation.
I mean, that's hard to do when you're a new grad, especially. I think that's part of the obstacle of being a new grad, and that's why it's sometimes just nice to talk to someone else. I've found myself at times, even a few years later, not having recently graduated, and still sometimes, especially at the end of the shift, just running over something with someone. And I've noticed myself at times just talking to one of the nurses or one of the techs, not because I'm expecting them to give me the answer even, but sometimes just having someone to talk to makes you think it through a little more thoroughly. And it comes about and you're like, yeah, that makes sense. Now I can explain, now I can justify this, or, oh, I didn't think about that. And one of the things we've talked about before very recently on the podcast is about medical decision-making. I use that as another stop point because I think about, how do I document this? How do I do this? Did I get all the testing I need to do, or did I overtest or stuff like that? So it is a challenge. I don't think there's a right answer here, but there are definitely ways you can do it.
I listened to that segment you did with Mike Weinstock. When I first started, I was typing all my notes, and then we got a dictation system set up and I started dictating more. And I found, like you said, talking over things with other people, whether it's the tech or the one of the nursing staff, is really helpful. I also feel like just dictating the note sometimes does that same function for me.
Yeah, so I guess this kind of ties in some ways because of how we talk about things. What about some of the benefits? What are some of the things that you feel like is a strong benefit to working in the environment you're working in currently?
The number one benefit is just the amount of learning that I'm getting to do and the things that I've been exposed to. After talking to my classmates, some of whom I think definitely thought I was a little crazy for taking this job, and hearing the types of positions they're in, types of things they're exposed to, and not just the medical aspects. You know, like if a chest pain patient comes in, then you know I'm responsible for managing that. I don't have a doctor that I have to pass that off to. And if there's a procedure to be done, then I get to do it, which is awesome. Like I really do enjoy that aspect of emergency medicine, getting to do those procedures. But then also the, maybe not as much medical things, but like the managing the flow in an emergency department to an extent that I know I would not have gotten to do if I'd been in a larger facility, or if I'd been doing more of a fast track position, or someplace where there's more doctors, where if 8 people show up in 1 hour, you know, like I really am responsible for figuring out how to keep things moving. And that's still really stressful. But I do remember the first time that happened, just feeling completely overwhelmed and just looking for somebody to come in and help me and bail me out. And I had a similar situation just a few shifts ago, and just being a lot more comfortable managing that type of flow. I think that's a huge benefit to being out here. It just makes you grow as a provider in ways that you might not otherwise.
essentially for that time frame while you're on shift, you are the leader, whether or not, like, I'm sure you probably have a charge nurse and things like that, but for your role, what you're doing, essentially you are leading this group of people, and that's going to be your job, is to help with flow and everything. And that may simply be that you have, like you said, 8 patients. Well, you only have 6 rooms in your department. 2 people are out in the waiting room. Okay, well, here are their complaints. Let's start ordering labs because I can only see one person physically at a time. And what I'll do is I'll start with my, you know, highest acuity, or maybe there's that 1 or 2 people I can just get out real quick, but I'm going to focus on the life threats first and make sure I get that. And if I can get anything else bonus wise, okay. And you may have those times, I don't know, but I'm sure in a department your size, you probably had the time when you may have 1 or maybe just 2 people in the department, and you may kind of work things a little bit differently, where you may spend a little more time working them up than say you would if you have someone who's, if you have a situation beyond your level of management that you can have in the whole department.
Absolutely. Maybe one of the downsides to that, it would be going back to where you were talking earlier about the tendency to overimage. I definitely find myself having to fight the urge to be like, oh, well, I've got 8 people here. You have belly pain. Oh, let's just get that CT done, and then we'll know what's going on, and just to keep things moving. I think it's really cool that I have the opportunity to learn how to do that.
So what are consults like for you? Because this is something that it took me a while to feel comfortable with consults. And honestly, there are some consults I'm still nervous about, but you don't get the option to pawn this off. Although I think I only really pawned off consults for the first few months. There's still some people I just hate consulting, but that's a different deal. But you don't get that option at all. There's no way you get to pawn off a consult. You're going to do it. You're going to have to suck it up. So how does it work out for you?
Still get nervous picking up the phone for consult. It's good that I don't have the option to sneak out on any of those, especially the hard ones. One of the nice things about it being small is that I recognize the cardiologist's names when they're on call. And I've talked to a number of them a number of times. And that, I think, just knowing their name, even if I've never met them or shaken their hand, having had conversations with them before makes it a lot easier. We have a transfer center that's actually located in Boise for one of the large hospital groups. And we'll call them. They'll find the specialist on call we need to talk to and then call us back. And I still remember when I was out here as a student, the first consult I did, and it was just a disaster. It was a total disaster. Flailing, I was having a hard time remembering. It was just, there's no organization. I did not like the way it went at all. So I've gone back and I've tried to continue to try to hone that. And I think I listened to a couple really good talks. I had a really good preceptor who made me rethink about the way I was doing those consults. It just, as far as what's the information you're leading with. It also ties a bit of back into what you were talking about, protecting the reputation of the group, where every time I pick up that phone for a consult, you know, it's not just my reputation that I'm thinking about. Like, am I throwing these guys just garbage consults? I don't want to dump. Nobody wants to dump patients on people. And like, have I done a thorough workup? Am I going to get on the phone with a specialist and they're going to ask me questions and I'm just going to be completely flat-footed? Which still happens sometimes.
And it's going to happen. I mean, let's face it for a second. You're going to have the specialist who, this has happened before, but they ask for some random ass test that you're like, no, this is not a typical thing to order, you know,
right.
or you say, or they'll ask you about, have you got this or that done yet? Well, no, part of the reason I wanted to call you is because this is something
that
comes up on my end. It's like the MRI. Well, no, I didn't get the MRI because realistically, they're going to be coming to your center either way, and I don't want to delay their treatment any longer.
Right. Or there was, and I'm sure you run into this too, where we're a small center, we run out of lab tests sometimes. Like, we had a few days where we ran out of BMPs. And sometimes they'll ask, like, oh, well, did you get this test? And I'll have to say, well, no, because I can't.
What do you mean you can't? No, I mean, literally, I can't.
We don't have strips for serum ketones right now. But I'd love to get it tomorrow morning, but I'd really like to get this DKA patient down to you before that. Or we only have some imaging. We usually don't have MRI or ultrasound at night, which is unfortunate because if you're concerned somebody's has a torsed testicle and it's 2 a.m., I hate to call a urologist and say, hey, can I send this person down to you so that they can get an ultrasound when they might be okay, but I'm not positive about it because I've never actually seen somebody with a testicular torsion. Those can be a little awkward. Those can be really hard to do.
especially if you don't have a place where they're going to give you great feedback afterwards. That's sometimes a real challenge. Maybe that person you saw was a torsion, but you'll never know, or you may not find out for weeks or months later until you see that person again. And you say, oh, yeah, you're the guy with that. Was that what it was? You know, sometimes you have a really hard ability to follow up on someone because they're not staying in the hospital where you can just check it the next day and say, hey, that's exactly what it was after all.
That is 100% accurate. And that's definitely something that is not a benefit to this position out here. That is definitely a drawback. I remember the first time I had a cardiologist actually call me back and be like, yeah, that STEMI you called, she had like 100% occlusion of her LAD. She's doing great now. We got everything opened up. And it was so great to get that feedback a few hours later. It was amazing. But that's the exception. That is definitely the exception. And sometimes it can be really hard to get that feedback, even when you're, you know, trying to get progress notes for a couple days afterward or a week after. And it does. It leaves you never really knowing, was that what I thought it was or not?
This is a corporate compliant way, and I can say that because I dealt with the whole corporate compliance side of this. There's a corporate compliant way that we went around with this, and your hospital may be small enough you don't have to worry about this as much, but we have business cards that we give patients. So what I do is I tell them to call us to give us that information about what happened, because it's amazing sometimes the patients will call back instead of the specialist. Because a lot of times you won't get the specialist to call back unless it's like what you said, the ultimate, hey, you did everything right, that's awesome. They're not going to call you to be like, yeah, that wasn't a torus testicle, you know, unless right. They're being a jackass maybe. But you know, usually they're not going to call you for that one. But they will call you for the huge, big save. Some of the times I had a great example of a patient who had caught equina, didn't get the MRI because it was too classic, and the specialist on the other end kind of bitched at me at first and said, why aren't you getting the MRI? And I said, two reasons. MRI is going to take a couple hours before they're in and they do the test, and this is what this is. You know you're going to need an MRI up there. Why are we screwing around with this right now? Let me just get this guy up here for you to assess. They didn't even do the MRI. They actually sent him straight to surgery, and that's truly what it was. Yeah. So those are the times that you feel good. But the surgeon didn't say anything to me. The surgeon told the family that we did such an excellent job, and then the family called us back and told us that.
That's awesome. That's a good idea.
So if you give them the number of the department when you're transferring someone out, and I mean, there are business card ways to do that and stuff like that. Obviously, for anyone listening, if you're interested in doing something like that, just make sure whatever it is corporate compliant, because that's a hoopla if you don't do it the right way. But there are easy ways to do that, and you can literally make business cards that your corporate compliance group will approve of, and it'll be fine. But I know not all hospitals necessarily have a corporate compliance group, but they'll have someone who's going to be responsible for that role to some degree, whether you know it or not. And usually HR will know who that person is.
No, that's a great idea. I like that. I have on occasion, and this was usually more when I sent somebody home with pretty strict follow-up instructions, called them a few days later to check in and see how things were going. And I've gotten good feedback that way. The other nice thing is the town we're in is 3,500 people, so it's pretty small, so it is not unusual to run into somebody in the grocery store or around town.
Do they ask you to look at the rash?
I have gotten people asking to look at things I've sutured up. Not the rashes yet. But it's coming. I know it's coming.
See, if you work night shift and then you go at Walmart at 4 a.m., no one's going to ask you about the rash. Or at least you can avoid that person. So now that I say this publicly, like, people will figure this out and they'll find me at 4 a.m.
Right.
Well, this is all great stuff. And actually, Aaron, we're going to have you back for a second round here, because you had a lot of questions for me that I think are great questions for us to cover. And so what I would like to do is actually, in this podcast here, and then it sounds like really soon we're going to have the second part. But before we leave, Aaron, can you give us the tagline?
You bet. Until next time, continue providing total care everywhere.